This episode of The H is brought to you in part by Human HQ. Human HQ is designed for folks who care about connecting over meaningful and open discussions about life, who desire to be an active part of a supportive community, and who seek to continuously improve and cultivate their best lives. It's a space for people who don't just talk about life, but do something about it, and want to surround themselves with others who do the same. Check out humanhq.org for more information, or follow them on Facebook and Instagram at HumanHQ. From Milieu Media Group, this is The H, a podcast about the people and places that make Houston, Houston. I'm your host, Luke Brauner, and this is Season 2, Episode 6, The Patient Hustler, with Basia Benchushan. As a little boy, growing up in Fort Worth, Texas, at a time when most of the kids I knew were happily occupied with things like trading baseball cards, playing soccer, and watching the original X-Men cartoon on Saturday mornings, I was out trying to find a job. I spent a fair number of my elementary school-aged afternoons walking to neighborhood pizza joints and pawn shops, filling out job applications in hopes that I could sweep floors or take out trash in exchange for pizza or used VHS tapes. There was something about the idea of having a real job that I believed would validate me in some way. Unsurprisingly, none of our local businesses were in the market for an 8-year-old with a cowlick and a bicycle, no matter how strong my work ethic may have been. So I was left with, as I saw it, only one option: entrepreneurship. Thus began my very first solo business venture, Luke's Vacation Service, in which I would tend the pets, plants, and mailboxes of traveling neighbors each summer. As I got older, my interest in the booming neighborhood vacation industry waned a bit, but my desire to work didn't. In the 3 decades since, I've had well over 50 jobs, doing everything from bagging groceries to booking shows for bands to working with at-risk youth. I've been a cameraman for a West Texas news station, a paralegal, a full-time musician, a busboy, an outdoor educator for a YMCA camp, a Starbucks barista, and basically everything in between. And throughout all of those jobs, I've always had some sort of side hustle going, often more than one. One of those side hustles, especially over the last few years, was writing social media content for large organizations and well-known musical artists, which is how in the fall of 2015, I first met native Houstonian and fellow social media professional, Basia Benchushan.
My name is Basia Benchushan. I am a mother of three, and I am the founder and CEO of Pink Cilantro, a digital brand building agency.
If you've listened to this podcast for any amount of time, then you've definitely heard the name Pink Cilantro. Every episode of The H ends with my mentioning their support of this show. They've been a faithful sponsor since day one of The H, but that isn't why I wanted to share Basia's story. When I met Basia, I could tell immediately that there was something unique about her. She was interviewing me on behalf of a local organization who was searching for someone to manage their social media accounts. I wound up being one of two people to get hired for that job, and we worked alongside Basia for the next several months. Eventually, I traded that particular side hustle in to focus on building out my podcast network. But Basia and I remained in touch, and when I began working on The H, hers was one of the first stories I wanted to tell. Her story began in Southwest Houston, in the predominantly Jewish community of Meyerland.
I'm one of six. I grew up in a highly entrepreneurial home. Both my parents had full scholarships to Ivy League schools, and my father came from Ukraine, and they drove into Houston from Ithaca, New York, and they fell in love with the city, and they decided to stay and make something for themselves in Houston.
And make something for themselves they did.
My parents built a computer company. They were a really big part of the computer revolution. When everybody had these big computers, my parents were servicing companies like HISD, Enron, Exxon, Shell, Coca-Cola. This was nationwide, to get personal computers for each employee. I grew up, my mother probably had about 5 hours a week for us, and it was on a Sunday. She would leave the house at 4:30, hit the gym, and head straight to the office and come home at 9. So we really had very little FaceTime with my mother. And my father, he is very creative. He is a mathematician, so he was a big part of developing a lot of the unique intellectual property for their company. But my mother was really a driver. She was one that would show up at the boardroom. There were no women at the table at that time. I mean, she was the first woman allowed to join the YPO.
YPO is the Young President's Organization, a global invitation-only network of young chief executives of high-revenue corporations. Currently, the YPO has a membership of nearly 25,000. But Basia's mother was the first female ever to be invited. And at a time when that sort of thing simply didn't happen.
The things that people would tell her would blow you away. And even her employees. She had male employees in a time where women were not on top. This was before email. They would write her hate mail because they were so offended. They had a female CEO. And she was really a driver. She really modeled in a way to say, you know, we're feeding thousands of families, and that's worth sacrificing so much face time with our children.
While that sacrifice may have paid off financially, it certainly took its toll in other ways.
Growing up in this highly entrepreneurial space, I watched their businesses grow from nothing, from pennies, you know, starting off with $50 and building it out to a multi-million dollar business. I watched her go through that journey, and there were times I remember my father and mother would have arguments in the kitchen about employees and not being able to hold on to certain employees. But my mother, she would always fight to keep these mouths fed because she knew that by continuing to put in the work and the daily grind and being patient and to show up, there would be success and for everyone, not just for her and her immediate family. So growing up, I was kind of jaded. I thought everybody was exposed to a workforce and processes and systems, and I was naive. We weren't spoiled children. What my parents gave us was a lot of education. They really pushed us. I remember as early as 8, we're all in the living room meditating, or we would read books together and have to compete against each other with these Chinese puzzles, and my father and mother would push us. My father was the one who was around more, and he would really push us to compete with ourselves. So I would say a highly competitive home, a high standard for education, and not a traditional education. Growing up, both my parents went to Ivy League schools. My father would, you know, kind of push that aside, saying, I don't really care if you go to college or not. It's really important for you to be empowered and educate yourself on what it will take to be successful. Now, when my father being an immigrant and really coming from nothing, there are limitations on being able to indulge in your creativity. And so for him, it was always very important for us to be practical in what we learned. But as now that we're all adults, he encourages us to really indulge in exploring our creative side and not just thinking about how that will allow us to build out financial freedom.
Financial freedom became a reality for Basia's parents in the mid-1990s when she was about 12 years old and the company they'd built from the ground up was purchased by General Electric. At that point, everything changed.
They were looking for a spiritual journey to take. My mother, she was still on as a VP for General Electric, but she was not putting in the same amount of work, and she decided to take a sabbatical to move to Israel and to really explore Judaism. We were exposed to practicing Jews, but we weren't practicing Jews. You know, we had our Yom Kippur and we had our Passover, but we would drive on the Sabbath and such. So when they moved to Israel for that year, we moved to Tzfat. And Tzfat, I don't know if you know anything about Tzfat, but it's an extremely artistic city. The beautiful art galleries. They say all the crazies end up in Tzfat. It's beautiful. The air is so clean. The mountain views is just breathtaking. And when we moved to Tzfat, they started to really immerse themselves in studies, daily studies and meditation, hiking and such. And make this transformation to become Orthodox, like full-time Orthodox Jews. And I really pushed back against that. And I started to rebel. My mother ended up having my brother, Chaim Mendel, who's 18 now, and he has Down syndrome. So there was a lot going on. And in Israel is when I kind of fell through the cracks and I didn't go to school. I would hang out all day. My parents thought I was going to school. I would hang out all day in the art galleries. And that's when I was really exposed to being able to apply color to paper and wood and canvas. I was always a very creative child, but when we moved to Tzfat, that's when I really understood. There wasn't a lot of paint in my house growing up, but I just got very excited and started to get very passionate about painting and illustration and such.
Do you feel like your parents affirmed that in you, or you just kind of had to discover it on your own?
I had to discover it on my own. We were all so busy. So many kids. Yeah. Everybody's building. My parents, my mother, even to this day, has to work. She has to build. That's her capacity. And respecting that is so important. As a child, I was so hurt by it to the point where I pushed back on building a business or even getting married and having children because I just didn't see the flavor of how that applied to living a good life. But it's her capacity. It's what her purpose is, and it's what she's been given to do, and she's really grabbed it full force. She continues to build, and not just within her own family, just the amount of people that she employs today. She has multiple businesses. But my parents would throw out comments like, okay, so if I had a school project, my father would get really excited to get involved in sculpting. If there was an art competition, I won all the art competitions. So you could tell I was obsessed with it, but I still didn't affirm within myself that this is actually, I'm the best. I was just like, okay, I just love doing this. I was so naive as a child. My father would say things like, you should do something like design or something, never a painter. You know, you're such a good people person. You should probably do sales. But when we moved to Israel and I was exposed to people who actually do this for a living, the people in art galleries, they weren't my age. These were anyone from the age between 20 to 85. And I saw that they lived a good life, eating their cheese, drinking their wine, their fresh bread, looking out at the mountains, painting all day, making their wax candles. You know, there was somebody who would weave with his loom all day. I mean, it was just, I was like, okay, you can actually explore this as something that you do forever. And I didn't think in the terms of do for a living. I thought, like, you can actually sustain your spirit and your mind on this forever. So they never affirmed that in me. I found that when I was 12 years old in the art galleries in Sfat.
Bassi's time in Sfat, discovering and falling in love with art, was as brief as it was formative. Her family returned to Southwest Houston a little over a year later, but Bassia was forever changed.
I would take pieces of trash and build constantly. I would sit for hours organizing glass beads and putting them into arrangements and sell these pieces of jewelry at school. I was crazy about it. I would take my fork at the dinner table and play with the colors, not the food, but the actual, like, ceramic design, and like in my mind visualize the painting that I was making. But I had no idea I was creative, and I had no idea what it was to love to paint so much, because like I said, my father was very practical. It's very common for within the Orthodox Jewish world to send your children to boarding school, and it's very hard to get accepted to the top boarding schools, and parents fight for this. So when I got back, I got accepted to a top boarding school in Pittsburgh, and I really didn't fit in. And not just because it was an Orthodox Jewish setting, but in any setting, I had a very hard time fitting in because I've always been extremely creative, but once I was exposed to like putting paint on, I would paint everything, furniture, carpet, everything, once I was exposed to that, there was no stopping my self-expression. And so shaving my head, purple lipstick and blue mascara, and just very colorful child. Just walking into any room, people were, oh, this must be a troubled child here. But the truth is, my strength that I bring to the table is my creativity. So the school had a hard time with the way I expressed myself, and they didn't want me back the next year. And the next year I ended up going to a school in Worcester, Massachusetts. And because of all the pushback from the system, and I wasn't willing to compromise on my self-expression. I mean, we would have fights about blue hair. We would have fights about green hair. And I wasn't willing to compromise. I would get very offended when, and it would hurt me, when, you know, it was taken away. Even painting. So I didn't last very long in this school in Worcester, Massachusetts, and my parents quickly realized that I really didn't fit into the traditional school system, but they wanted to make sure that I was using my time wisely. And also, I was very bored in the classroom. I was not a failing student. I was passing. I just really caused a lot of distraction. So we don't need to go into all those details, but I ended up dropping out in about eighth grade.
Once Basia's parents accepted that the traditional school model wasn't the best fit for their daughter, they found alternative arrangements for her back in Israel.
It wasn't a school, but like a boarding space in Israel where they take these creatives who don't really fit in and aren't thriving, and they give them the opportunity to really explore their creative side. And I ended up staying in Israel for 2 years, and I spent some time living with a printmaker with a 40-ton press and a paper maker, and working on these big papier-mâché sculptures and really getting my hands dirty within the art scene and creating a nice volume of work. Now, there was a little bit of a problem with this school, because at this school, they were very free and open with exploring your creative side, but they didn't really have a lot of boundaries. And when you are 14 without boundaries, there's a lot of trouble to be had. So I ended up having to come back to America.
So after 2 years in Israel, at the age of 16, Basia returned yet again to the U.S. Unfortunately, trouble seemed to follow her all the way back to the States. That is, until about a year later, when she crossed paths with someone who could offer just what she needed, a challenge.
It wasn't until I was 17 that I met this woman, Becky Butcher, and she said to me, "Hey, Basia, you don't have any school credits, do you?" And I said, "Well, no, I guess not. I didn't go to high school." And she said, "Well, you know, there's the GED, but there's also an option that you can do your 4 years of high school online. And, you know, what's 4 years? You'll be, you know, 21 and you'll have your high school diploma. I know you're very capable and you can do that." And I said, "You know, yeah, the GED sounds a little lame." And at the time, you know, with my art, I was showing in spaces, I was selling to professional buildings. I did build up a bit of reputation with that. Naturally, having a mother who's a killer saleswoman and runs a business, it just came to me very naturally to convert my art into sales to be able to pay for my rent.
So at 17, while making a living as an artist, Basia accepted Becky's challenge and began working on her high school education. And in the process, learned an important lesson about herself.
I didn't know I had this work ethic in me, this like my mother, but when I touched the keyboard, I was on fire. Till 3 a.m, I'd submit paper. I ended up finishing high school in 14 months. That's when I was, it's not about finishing in 14 months. It's a, that for me, there was a transformation where I realized that my work ethic is unique. For a long time, I thought everybody could put in that amount of work.
But most people don't share Basia's work ethic because most people didn't grow up with parents like Basia's.
I do have a different perspective when it comes to just creative solutions. That has to do naturally being that I have an artist soul, but also my mother exposed me to operations, systems, sales, showing up, and having my father kind of have us challenge ourselves. We weren't competing with our siblings, challenge ourselves. Nothing was good enough. He's always critical. And it's not from a bad place. You got to the top of this step. What's the next step? What's the next step? You got that Chinese puzzle done? Let's get this riddle done. Like, so after I finished this high school degree, it still didn't click what I was going to do. I'm obsessed with creating. I didn't want to even think about building a family, having a business. I was so turned off from the traditional dream that everybody had.
So she continued pursuing art, but even her art was evolving.
There was a shift that I had when I was about 18, 19. I started to do furniture because I had this itch where I felt like one painting really didn't impact enough people. And like I got into painting a lot of doors because I felt like hundreds of people would open this door and sit on a chair. Or in my house now today, I have a lot of furniture that I've made or collaborated with other artists to make.
Her pursuit of art led her out west to California, and she did well there, developed a reputation, and received a fair amount of attention from the art community. But eventually she moved back to Houston once and for all. She found an apartment in Meyerland near her parents, and there she got even more attention, but this time from a young man named Tomer.
He saw me walking around one day, and he said to his cousin, "Who is that little redhead? I really would like to meet her." He said, "Well, she's a part of the Jewish community. I can get her number." And he called me up, and I didn't agree to meet with him first. But he said, "I live in your apartment complex." And I was like, "Okay, I guess I should meet this man." And he came over, and we just started hanging out every day. And a year later, we were married.
Before we get too far into her story with Tomer, there was another significant event in Bossy's life in the season between California and her return to Houston. A month-long road trip with her dad, in which she discovered a new passion for yet another form of self-expression and a new home for her remarkable work ethic.
This is how I knew I was supposed to be an entrepreneur and also how I needed to be in the digital space. This is when I gave up expressing myself with paintbrushes because it's always been within me. What I was aware of as a child was that I was always very tuned in to the world in a way that's, there's a much bigger purpose than myself, and it pains me to see so many people abusing each other. You know, I was very moved by bad things. When I heard about bad things that happened in the world, it would affect me in a big way. And when I was painting, I got very bored, and that's why I moved to furniture, because I felt like it was very self-serving. So when I moved back from California to Houston, my father took me on a month-long road trip, and we went to Canada, and he introduced me to one of his entrepreneurial colleagues who built out a lot of software. And what he was really hot on right now is social networks. This was MySpace time. Twitter was like just budding. Twitter was like AOL chat rooms where you could be very intimate and like you could talk directly to celebrities, and there weren't many celebrities on Twitter at the time. So we spent about 2 weeks in Canada with them. Other 2 weeks we were driving and exploring, and Lanny took a look at me, his colleague, and said, "You need to be involved in this social media craze because they will love you." And I'm like, I was very turned off by technology because I grew up in such a intense, we weren't allowed to watch TV. We were meditating. We weren't allowed to eat sugar. And we had 8 computers in our playroom that nobody had computers that we would come home and have to play on. No TV, nothing. Like, it was intense. So I was a little turned off by all of that. And I thought everyone grew up like that. That's also the piece. So, you know, he said, "I want you to get involved with one of my projects." And I said, "I'll think about it. Whatever. I'm just painting. I'm living this creative bohemian life." And when we drove back down to Houston after I met Tomer, we got married. I said, "Well, I'm married. Now I think that I need to find something to do other than painting." And I reached out to Lanny, and he gave me a contract job. And when he gave me that contract job, I registered Pink Cilantro as a business, not an agency. I had no big vision, no big picture. Once I was exposed to, first of all, the walls that the digital spaces took down, how you connect with people, Twitter blew my mind. And then when I saw the data and how you could really take the next step based on positive reactions that you saw behind the scene, I was hooked. You couldn't stop me. 18 hours on the computer. Like, I was hooked. So I was still exploring. I played around a lot. I brought very creative solutions to the table that brought strong results. And from there, it led to another piece of work and another client and another client and another client, until one point I just said, "Okay, maybe I should hire my first employee. This is a lot of workload." I was very controlling about not outsourcing any of my work. I did all of them from start to finish. Analytics, billing, design, copywriting, everything, everything. I'm amazed that my husband stuck around because I would work so hard and that he was so patient enough to wait it out, because I didn't know who I was and I was still exploring and I'm putting in so much time without getting paid much. My payment was being able to explore this space with some very exciting brands and take them to the next level.
So if you had to articulate what it was about all of that that hooked you, what was it? What was it about social media that you were just like, "I have to be a part of this. I have to explore this space"?
The data got me very excited. The fact that it wasn't even just about sales numbers. It had to do with the fact that anyone could say whatever they were thinking. And when you saw people saying words of value and it really changing your mindset, I couldn't put that down. The impact that these spaces have, there's no boundaries. We're a global, we're one universe. When I'm able to talk to somebody in India and really go deep with somebody on India, like, how could you not be moved? Now we're so used to it, but how could you not be moved? I remember when they were catching Osama bin Laden on Twitter, you can feel somebody said that there were bullets ricocheting. They heard it. What's going on in the neighborhood? And then being somebody who's working behind the scenes for businesses that are converting to sales or getting celebrity endorsements without the middleman and closing book deals without the middleman, I already know that this is just the beginning. This is just the beginning. It makes us more efficient. It makes us humans more accountable. You see, there's this group in Saudi Arabia called Stealthy Freedom Fighters. And what it is women will drive. Now it's legal to drive, but it wasn't legal for a long time. And women with their husbands on Facebook. And what does that tell their neighbor? That maybe they also feel the same way. And then it changes policy. Businesses have become more accountable because of social media. People have become more inspired and accountable. Look at what happened with Harvey. People who wouldn't have necessarily known who to help and how to assist. Most of the rescuers out there, this is not their profession, not their full-time job. But they were able to connect in efficient ways because of the tools that we have, whether it was through WhatsApp, Facebook, email campaigns. So
you feel like you had a glimpse of that back then?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was the ability to connect with someone all the way in India, somebody who you would never have met, the ability to do business with somebody who you wouldn't have access to before. And then also being, I'm looking at the back end. A lot of people don't realize with these digital spaces, you're so used to using the front end and the user face. When you're looking at the back end and you look at the data, all of a sudden you realize that you can move in more efficient ways. You can actually touch and move people. You can listen to how the market behaves. These insights really can steer what your next move should be. I didn't understand it, the maturity that I understand it now, but when I was exposed to it, I said, impact, purpose, we can change the world. This makes things more efficient. And also there was another piece that everything's accessible. I'm excited for the day that we'll have a doctor that doesn't go through the traditional school system and have to invest that amount of time and money versus we have a customer right now that's working on, they have the biggest medical library. So it really breaks down every piece of the human body and 3D animated. They're working on a virtual reality piece of content that really walks through the entire body to study the entire body. I'm excited for the day that there is somebody who goes out and consumes enough content around the human body and understands it and interns, has the opportunity to intern, whether it's with a cousin or father or whatnot, with the patient and ends up bringing an innovative, smart solution to the table that saves lives without having to go through the traditional education system. They just come with their case studies and say, look what I did to save this person's life. Let me continue to have a seat at this table and save others' lives. So I also saw that there was just so much information that was accessible. And for me, that was because of my non-traditional educational background. For me, I just saw so much accountability in that.
So with a clear vision for the tremendous potential of social media to change the world, a lifelong passion for creative self-expression, a supportive husband, and her parents' entrepreneurial spirit and extraordinary work ethic, there was nothing that could stand in Basia's way of turning Pink Cilantro into a digital marketing force. Not even kids. She and Tomer, who's also an entrepreneur, have three daughters. Noya, born in 2009. Ayelet, born in 2010. And Shaked, born in 2015.
Both my husband and I work long hours. Now I have the luxury of putting in 12-hour days, but there was a time when I really didn't, like 18, 20 hours, easy. Even with Shaked, when I had Shaked, we'd be at the office till 10 p.m. My husband would call, when are you coming home? I would have the bassinet and everything here. I was very insistent on breastfeeding my kids. So a nanny can't breastfeed my kid for me. And so I trailed Shaked along to the office for 5 months until I just ran out of milk. Noya and Ayelet both got breastfed for 15 months, but Shaked, I was like just spreading myself too thin.
Basia works hard to strike just the right balance so that building a successful business doesn't get in the way of being an attentive, present wife and mother.
Tomer works 18-hour days, 6 days a week. I work 5 days a week. Saturday, because we're Orthodox Jews, we turn off on Friday night and Saturday. We cannot have our phones. We don't drive. We're limited to our community. We walk to the synagogue. We have really intimate time with our family. You know, you have a meal, you break out the wine, you break out the bread, you have to have a full-on spread. It's like Thanksgiving every weekend with no phone, which is amazing. Like, it's such a meditation. And also mixing in prayer and mixing in moments that you have to stop and connect with a higher power. It's very intentional time. But on Sunday, my husband goes back to work. I take that day, and it's almost like it's like a rave for my children. I work so hard on Sunday for them. Typically, what we do is we head out at 9, we head to the gym, and then we go pick up bagels at the bagel shop and get some cream cheese. We can go out and have a picnic, or we go to the museum for anywhere from 3 to 4 hours. We go to Herman Park, or we go to some festival that's going on. Then we do some grocery shopping or maybe shopping at Target. And then we have movie night at night. And that's when I get back on the laptop and just check in on things. Then I get back to the kids and tuck them into bed. And then I get back on and prepare for Monday. But we have a very specific schedule and balance. When I come home from work, and this wasn't always the case, when I come home from work, I have to be intentional about being there with the kids. There was a point in time when Noya would say, like, why are you so grumpy? And I would say, I just had a really long day. There's so much going on. I'm very sorry. And there was a point where I just got tired of that. And now I have magical moments with Noya and Ayala. And you know, Shaked, she doesn't express herself in this way. She's already used to my schedule. But where she says, wow, I love being in this moment with you. You know, we talk about this. We're very honest about this. I'm the one who takes them to carpool every day. Their school's a mile away. I'll walk Noya and Shaked to the school to get my exercise in. And then I'll come back and take Ayala. But when I'm walking her to that school, it's that 15, 20 minutes. And we have very deep moments where it's not time that's spent in earbuds or complaining. It's time that we're talking about our experiences and what's going on. And then when I come home from work, I'm the one, my husband puts in 18, 20-hour days. He's exhausted. He has so much on his plate. And when I come home, I take that minute in the driveway, take a deep breath, and I reset. I have a little meditation moment. I reset. I come in, and I just stick my nose into my baby Shaked's hair, and it's like a new day. And I just pump up the jam with the kids. You know, we check the homework for a second. Give kisses, hugs. They are bombarding me, telling me about the day, what's going on. And we all eat a little snack together. And then sometimes we play music. They're already bathed by the time I come home. And everything's clean. That's helpful. But we're very intentional. Bedtime is just like a little party. We have dance parties, and then we have our story time. And they tell me about their day.
What sort of business is
he? He has a construction agency. He's really good at what he does. His business acumen is very different than mine because he doesn't have my background. When it comes to building and putting together the project and keeping everyone inspired and encouraged and really making sure that it goes well, I'm amazed every time. He's magic to me, and such a different type of magic. And we both had to find ourselves. When we met each other, we didn't know what we wanted to do. He ended up working for one of my mother's companies. So she has several companies, but one of them is surgical supplies. He was doing sales because he's really good at sales. And when he wanted to go off and do his own thing, I liked it, but I didn't know how that would go because I was thinking, you don't know anything about operations. It was so bad. And I have to say, working through us finding ourselves to become better parents every day, this is just the beginning. So I feel like because we have the capacity to give this to these beautiful souls that are in our life, I feel like it might be wasteful for me not to have another one or two because we're able to give to them. What else is there to do?
One of the most rewarding parts of motherhood for Basia is recognizing the same creative instinct she discovered as a kid in her daughters.
She likes to collect trash and make like little sculptures. After Harvey, she made this like sweet little boat and gave it to her girlfriend who flooded out of her house. I just wanted to cry because I saw me and her. But she'll walk for, like, if I could give her this option, and I used to do this. I used to walk around the neighborhood picking up trash and making things. My glue gun was my best friend. And with her, she does the same thing. She'll hunt, constantly be hunting on the ground for things to make. So it wasn't until we moved to Israel that I really understood that this is a lifestyle. And when growing up, that's not a lifestyle. You don't have that luxury. Like, what are you going to do with that? So it's interesting when I have conversations with my daughter, Noya, who is a copy of me or optimized version of me. We'll see. I tell her, I really want you to understand that your perspective is so unique. The way you illustrate, it takes my breath away. Not because you get every detail down. It's because the details that you create are so unique. You see the world through a different lens. And I think now you're seeing a bit of a trend around this, but it's surface level. But having a unique perspective, naturally, it's not ignited enough within the traditional system, school system, and society. If you don't walk in fitting in, people don't embrace that. If anything, they bully that. Now you see conversations around, let's be open, let's let others in, let's explore the unknown, let's bring more diverse heads to the table in business, because we know that that's a competitive edge. But creatives get lost in this sauce because they have to have some practical skills, but they're lost in the sauce because for so long they're told singing a song won't feed you, sharing your craft won't feed you. And what I love about the digital space is it's really taking down that barrier. It's really, how hard do you want to work to have impact? And it really shows, what do we value? What do we value? So I'm hopeful that you're seeing a lot of shifts in curriculum. I'm hopeful that exploring how you can turn your creativity into a gift for the world and how you can really apply it in a way that the world will give something back to you in return will come into play.
So how does being CEO of Pink Cilantro scratch that creative itch for you?
It wasn't until late 2014 that I hired my first employee and started building out an agency. So for the first 2 years, I was very much so involved in production and the creative direction of most of the campaigns. So that really scratched a creative itch. Right now, I'm not very involved in the client campaigns. I'm involved in building out what Pink Cilantro, our products, our service offerings. We also have O Cilantro, which is my personal brand. I do a lot of coaching and consulting and really problem solving for organizations that are very big and scared to make big adjustments when it comes to digital solutions, because they understand that it's going to be painful at first financially, and then within their existing teams, there's going to be a lot of pushback. So you have to handle it in a way that really brings the team along. So I really do a lot of problem solving, and that's really how I express myself creatively. I paint from time to time, but not the way I used to paint. I used to paint for 12 hours straight. Now I paint for 2 hours with the kids. I could put on a really great art class. We do a lot of arts and crafts at the house. We have big brown paper rolls, and there's always paint out. So I doodle a bit, but really the way I get to exercise my creative side is through problem solving and building out strategic plans for when I do my consulting and when I build out products for Pink Cilantro and as we continue to expand what our next move will be.
So when you look forward now at where things are headed, what is your vision for Pink Cilantro?
It's big. It's a big vision. It's not really about me. I know that right now we have the ability to make daily changes to people's lives and inspire them. And we are blessed with the opportunity to work with customers that, you know, change people's lives daily and their necessities in their life. I want to continue to build a machine that, if we want to cure cancer or if we want to invest our time in changing the way that consumers shop, I really want to create a machine that I can apply to anything to really change the world on a much grander scale. Right now, we touch millions of people on a daily basis between our clients, millions. And I know that I have the capacity to build out a machine that can continue to make positive impact and give people a space to be a part of that. I see myself eventually stepping away from Pink Cilantro to explore other creative sides of me. You know, we invest a lot within the culture of our team. And I hope one day that I'm able to step away from Pink Cilantro and see it continue to grow and challenge our approach to talking to consumers or talking to the world. I do have to add this, though, because Pink Cilantro, we're a digital brand building agency, but we're not a traditional agency. There are a lot of misconceptions when it comes to marketing and digital marketing as a whole. Our approach is very data-driven, and we also don't let our customers come in and tell us what they need in the sense of, we need a website or we need a Instagram. I mean, they could tell us they need to be posting on Instagram or on Facebook, but what we really like to do is we like to hear their short-term goals and long-term goals, and build out a roadmap and position them in a way that they can actually achieve those goals by jumpstarting campaigns and then taking the insights to really steer how the market responds to new product launches or how the market responds to some of their new ideas.
Bossy and her team work tirelessly to build digital marketing campaigns for their clients. I've been around their office a few times over the last few years and met several of her employees, and they all tend to describe her in the same way. This is Shelby and Rachel, two of her account managers at Pink Cilantro.
It's just constantly, a constant stream of just thoughts and ideas. And if we showed you, Slack channels, it's every, hour to 2 hours, Bossy is like, well, what about this? What about this? Let's do this. So it's, a constant stream of just thoughts and ideas and art and over here and over there. It's insane.
She never stops going. We get Slacks from her at 10, 11, 12 p.m. and then she's up again at 4 a.m. And we worry, we're do you sleep? What do you do? Because she is always, always going and always working. And no matter what happens, she's not going to stop working towards that goal.
How does that challenge you as her employee?
It challenges us to help her slow down because you may be going from 4 a.m. to 12 p.m. and all that. But you have to slow down and flesh out those ideas. And so it challenges us to help her slow down and help her see, we got to work through every teeny tiny step. I can't work at a million miles a minute like you do. She's so talented. And so it challenges us to step up to her level and to help her see that we're not there right now. So she has to help us get there.
Creative, driven, patient, talented, persistent. These are the words Bossy's employees use to describe her. But I was curious how she'd describe herself.
What would you say today is your defining characteristic?
I can really outwork a lot of people, and I take a lot of pleasure in it. I don't even feel it. I could sit at a desk or go back to back to back through meetings. Give me 20 hours and I'm good. My husband's the one who brings me back to life. So I can grind really hard. And I would say my biggest strength that I bring to the table is my creativity. I have a different perspective, and I'm lucky enough to have the background from my mother and father to have the business acumen and strategic outlook that I have today. So putting all that together, I'm able to build and apply it to work and family.
Applying those principles at work came pretty naturally to Bossia, but when it came to family, there was a bit of a learning curve.
When you have your first kid, for anyone, whether you're a working mom or not, there's a little getting used to. Because you all of a sudden, you have a natural love for this child, but you start to develop this need to nurture this human being more than yourself. So after the first one, you really learn that it's very rewarding to give to these beautiful human beings, because as they grow, you see the fruits of your labor. And I don't want to miss a day. I don't want to miss a moment. It took me a while. Noia was difficult to find the balance between work and family and even, I would say, a relationship with my husband or myself. My husband, he holds me accountable to really not work as much as I do. For us, it was a bit of a struggle for how much time I would invest into a project without necessarily getting immediate return. But I'm a very patient hustler. I can grind out and understand that long-term what that return will look like. So I guess I apply that day-to-day with my children. There was a moment that I woke up with Noia saying, I need to be very intentional about how we spend our time. Even from small things, how much time I spend eating. Not with the kids, but so that I can really make it home and be there with the kids and be present. So with the encouragement of my husband, saying you really have to find the healthy balance, and then also naturally not being happy with the fact that I'm not giving them my everyday like I give my work, I choose to show up. I choose to show up every day. You choose to show up several times a day. You choose to show up a certain way. You go from meeting to meeting. Every meeting you have to show up very intentional. There's no way around that. I don't want to waste my time. We all are here for a limited amount of time. And my kids, I need to pour into them so that they can also have this approach to life. I feel like we take it too easy. And I hate to do that because I'm maybe I'm my dad. And I know, let's take it easy. Let's just go to the beach and relax. And my husband helps me to relax. But I have this thing within me, this calling within me that says you need to make those intentional deposits so you leave the world a much better place. And then now you have these human beings and you need to make sure you're making those intentional deposits to them so that they leave the world a better place. And God willing, they'll be able to do that for whoever they touch, whether they have children or they have whatever they do. I just want them to make sure they leave this world a much better place than they found it. And not in a way that people are necessarily smiling, but changing the education system, adjusting the way that we consume so much stuff, valuing stuff over empathy, being able to leave like deep impressions around those, not just surface level. Like, we can all be kind and sweet to each other on a daily basis. I just feel like there's more. And when you have that capacity, there's a lot of luck that goes into it. I'm lucky I was born into this entrepreneurial home. My daughters are lucky they were born into a home with my husband is such an amazing man. He's dynamite, and they're lucky. So I just don't want to waste that. We've got opportunity. It's like I'm sticking my middle finger up at life if I don't take it seriously. You see a lot of people just doing without really understanding why they're doing it. Like, you'll see a lot of people are selling something they don't really even believe in. First step is taking a step back. Don't dwell on it. Don't make excuses for yourself to find out, what are you really good at? Call yourself out on it. And once you do that, you're going to have to put in the work to explore that further. Just like I said, for many years, I did my work for peanuts. And my reward was really understanding this space better than a PR agency will offer social media. I want to laugh. The ins and outs of it, the way that they collect data, it's embarrassing. So understand that, really identify, call yourself out on what you're good at, and then pour yourself into it. Stop making excuses. How many hours of sleep do you need? 8, 6, 4, whatever. The rest of the day, really identify where you have room to continue to pour into what you want to get done. Because if you really want to build something, you're going to have to put in the work. Call yourself out on what you're good at and pour yourself into it and commit to it. It's so important to create consistent schedules for yourself. Being intentional about how you spend your time. Everyone's so easygoing, and then they want to be a millionaire next year, and I just can't help but roll my eyes and say, what have they been marketed in the past few years? They think they can do that without putting in the work. I want people to call themselves out on what they're good at. Not enough people are brave enough to tell themselves what they're good at, and that's something that holds them back for a long time. They end up pouring a lot of energy into something they don't even love.
Maybe you weren't born into a successful, driven, entrepreneurial family. Maybe you don't know how to turn your passion into a career. Maybe you don't even know what you're passionate about. As I said, I've had over 50 jobs in my life and at least half a dozen different side hustles. Luke's vacation service eventually died off. And in high school, I started another business, a video production company called Etc. Productions. Then when that died, I started a band that carried me through my 20s. And now in my 30s, a podcast network. I was, as I so often am, so encouraged by Bossia's words. Friends, life is short. Don't settle for something you don't love. We're halfway through the second season of The H, and so far we've had professional magicians, tattoo artists, painters, YouTubers, craft bartenders, urban farmers, bloggers, and reporters on the show, to name only a few. And all of these people, Bossia included, are taking their passions and pouring their whole lives into them. And they're finding, in this city, a home. Whatever it is that stirs you up, that keeps you awake at night, that seems impossible or out of reach, maybe you should take a chance. Show up, do the work, and see what happens. Maybe there's a home in this city for your passion too. Huge thanks to Bossia, Shelby, Rachel, and the entire staff of Pink Cilantro for the way they serve this city and for being a part of the show. Be sure to follow them on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Pink Cilantro. And thanks as always to you for listening and sharing The H. Follow us on all social media outlets at The H Podcast. And if you don't mind, do me a favor and tell a friend about this show. I love you, Houston. I'll be back in 2 weeks with another new episode. Thank you. This episode of The H was produced and edited by me, Luke Brauner. Our artwork is by our amazing friends at Spindletop Design in the Heights. Our theme song is by Robbie C., and other songs featured in this episode are by Houston-raised piano prodigy Cameron Pissera and my very talented friend Scott Benton. This and every episode of The H is brought to you by Pink Cilantro, a social-first digital agency who, as you heard in this episode, is about the work of making the world a better place. Check them out at pinkcilantro.com. Now here's a scene from our next episode.
They put me through a ritual where they, you know, jump you inside of a gang or whatever. So I almost died because the wind got knocked out of me. But technically, I would be a blood if I was active in it.